Hello, and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Joe Keating.
And I'm Dave Marshall.
How you been doing, Dave?
I've been doing fine, thanks, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Missioning on. I've got three papers I'm writing at the moment, and I've done a little bit of each, but not a lot of any of them.
Yeah. Well, it's better than what I've been doing, which has just been sitting about all day, every day. Just paleocasting, cleaning, you know, I get given a list of chores to do every day, which isn't fun.
Didn't you say you got sent some samples?
Yes, and then just a few days ago I got sent some samples. So it's not always on the oil rigs that you do this work. You can get it sent to you if it's not as time critical a job. And so I've got a big box of samples to get through, which is going to take quite a while, actually. But, yeah, I've got that to be doing in the meantime. So that's all the fun I've been having.
Oh, I just got my my poster accepted for Pallas, so that's good.
Oh, did you? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a shame you didn't get a talk, because then we'd be able to live stream it on PaleoCast.
Yes, nice link.
Nice link. So here in the Northern Hemisphere, where Joe and I are, and quite a lot of our listeners are, sorry if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, but summer's over here for us, and that means no more barbecues. And speaking of barbecues, today's episode is all about charcoal. What a link. It's almost as if we haven't practiced that.
Shush, they want it to be like ad-libbed.
So today we're joined by Professor Andrew Scott of Royal Holloway University, who's going to talk to us all about charcoal and charcoalification as a preservational method in the fossil record. And also don't forget to check out the website, where we've got so much multimedia with this episode. We've got tons of pictures, we've got a couple of videos, we've even got a link to another podcast. And at the end, right at the very bottom, we've got a half-hour-long video where Professor Andrew Scott takes us through some of his actual specimens that you see in the pictures. He takes us through those, actually looking at them live on the SEM. So first off, could you tell us a little bit about Professor Andrew Scott? How did your research interests develop, and how did you get into looking at fire in the fossil record?
Well, I suppose it was about 40 years ago when I started my PhD with Bill Challoner. And I was interested in carboniferous vegetation and its ecology. And I thought, well, a lot of people have looked at the sort of spectacular fossil plants you find in the coal measures. These deposits of 320 million years ago that are just so common in Britain and, of course, across Europe and North America. And you go to museums, you see these lovely fronds of vegetation. I thought, well, I want to learn about the ecology of these, you know, where they lived, how they lived. But I also saw that there's not only the potential of looking at spectacular compression fossils, but I wondered what was preserved as small little fossils within the rocks. So the first thing I did when I started my research was to take a lump of the shale and dissolve it in acid, because the organic material is not attacked by the acid, and started looking at residues of these little, almost like fossil tea leaves, if you like, that kind of size of material. And I recognised almost in the first week of my PhD, beautifully preserved tiny leaves, fossil leaves. It was at a time at the early stages of scanning electron microscopy. So we started looking at these leaves under the scanning electron microscope and showed that they were beautifully preserved. This kind of blew me away, and I thought, well, how are they preserved? And we realized that these were actually charcoal. These were fossil charcoal. It showed three-dimensional anatomy. And of course, charcoal has the effect that it's nearly pure carbon, so it doesn't tend to decay very much. So we then started thinking, well, what about fire? Because fire would be the mechanism to produce this charcoal. What do we know about fire in the Carboniferous? And I started looking into what had been written, and there was virtually nothing, except there were some comments in the literature that, oh, you couldn't have fire in the Carboniferous because it was always wet and raining, and which seemed to be a bit ridiculous. And they said, oh, you don't get fire in peat-forming environments. Well, actually, you do. If you go to Florida today, for example, in some of those peat-forming systems, fire is a major hazard. So immediately we thought, well, actually, there must be fire in the Carboniferous. So the first sort of impact we had was trying to understand that. Of course, it's not that straightforward, because people had recognised that there was charcoal in the Carboniferous in coal. Because when you pick up a piece of coal, while you get your hands dirty, it's because of the charcoal in coal. But people, when they started looking at this more ancient material, hadn't called it charcoal, they called it fusaine, the French term, if you like, for charcoal. And there was a thought amongst the coal community that fusaine was formed in some other way, it wasn't actually charcoal. So the first 20 years of our research was trying to persuade people and to demonstrate that actually fusaine and charcoal were the same thing. So in other words, when you found this black material that gets your hands dirty but has beautiful anatomy, it's fossil charcoal, and it was the result of ancient forest fires, or ancient wildfires, I should say.
So what is actually charcoal? We all know it from our barbecues, little kind of like just chunks of burnt wood, is it?
Well, it can be. It can be actually charred anything. Essentially, again, there's a misconception about how charcoal is formed. Charcoal is formed by intense heat upon plant, in fact, also on some animal material. But essentially, let's talk about plant material. If you heat plant in the absence of oxygen, it dries off some of the organic compounds and preserves a nearly pure carbon skeleton, which is charcoal. So this is what we call pyrolysis. When you burn something, what you do is that you go through this initial high heat, which gives off some of these volatile compounds. Those volatile compounds mix with atmospheric oxygen and they burn, because that's what it is, what combustion is. It's actually an oxidative reaction. So as you have a piece of wood, you know, how do you start a fire? Well, for example, in a wildfire, it'd be a lightning strike. Well, that lightning strike will hit a piece of wood or a trunk or a tree and have a very high temperature. That high temperature volatilizes some of the organic compounds in the wood. That mixes with the oxygen and it can start to flame. And of course, then it becomes a reaction which can continue, because that heat then is driving off more of these gases, which mix with more oxygen, which continues the burning process. So having atmospheric oxygen is actually key to this. And so if you like, what you do with after a wildfire, even your bonfire, you've got November the 5th, for example, and you're having your Guy Fawkes bonfire, at the end of it is material which has not been completely combusted. And so that material is charcoal. Now, the feature of that charcoal, if you sort of scrabble around that ash at the bottom of your bonfire, you'll find that it's black, it's brittle, it gets your hands dirty. But if you take a piece of it and look under a hand lens, you'll see the anatomy of that plant material is beautifully preserved. Now, of course, people tend to think about wood charcoal, or these large sort of pieces of charcoal, but actually anything can be preserved as charcoal. Not only wood, but leaf material, even pollen organs, and strangely enough, people don't realise even some flowers are preserved as charcoal. So again, that if I've often called fire as being charcoal, is that being preserved by fire rather than being destroyed by fire. So you might think of fire as purely destructive, but actually it leaves a residue which has a very potential long fossil history. It can survive because it's nearly all pure carbon and won't tend to decay in the fossil record.
Well, a fire is nonetheless destructive, so do you lose a lot of information? Can charcoal only ever be partially as good as a well-preserved petrified piece of wood, for example?
No, in some cases it's better. This mechanism of charring preserves the three-dimensionality of that material with the organic wall still preserved, and allows you, with, say, the scanning electron microscope, to see the anatomy of the plant material absolutely beautifully. As I say, you can see a whole range of internal anatomy. You can see the detailed structures. I've got carboniferous ovules, if you like, seed-like structures, which have glandular hairs still preserved, whereas the ovules are only a millimetre in size. The glandular hairs are spirally arranged. They're absolutely gorgeous. And so you've got complete internal anatomy. Now, of course, because that material is brittle, it may be that, you know, in order to see inside, you feel you have to break it up. But now there are techniques you can use, for example, using the synchrotron radiation, which is a new paleontological technique, which allows you to actually visualize inside the fossil without actually destroying it. So if you like, it provides an X-ray version of inside the fossil, and you can get beautiful three-dimensional internal anatomy without any destruction of the fossil at all. So obviously in some cases you might think, oh, it's going to have destroyed something, because you're thinking of the flaming side of the fire. You're not thinking of what's happening to a lot of that plant material that might be in a bed of litter where it's not exposed to the flame but just exposed to the heat, whereby that's transformed to charcoal in that circumstance.
Can you only ever get partial fossils then in that respect?
Well, it depends what you mean by partial fossils. The answer is, if you're not going to get a whole tree trunk preserved as charcoal, you'll get pieces of the wood preserved as charcoal. Unless, of course, it's preserved in a pyroclastic flow.
Okay.
And you think of it, because a pyroclastic flow from a volcanic eruption, that ash is hot. And so if you get a tree trunk preserved in a pyroclastic flow, it's been exposed to the heat, it's undergone this pyrolysis, but it's had no exposure to oxygen, so it's never burned. So you actually can get complete tree trunks preserved as charcoal, but in that very special circumstance. So generally speaking, you tend to find only small pieces. But of course, you get a lot of plants which have small leaves, which have small pollen organs or a number of other bits, where you get the whole thing preserved. So our early flowers, they're only about 1 or 2 millimetres in size, and they're completely preserved, beautifully preserved, with even the pollen inside, the pollen parts of the flowers. And even in sporangia, we've got very ancient fern sporangia from the early Carboniferous with the spores still inside, and these can be imaged. So you can get complete organs. Some of the small conifer leaves that I described earlier are complete leaves. So they're little needle-like leaves, about 1 or 2 millimetres long, but they're complete. So again, it depends on what you mean by a complete fossil, but that's, you know, you can get such a range of material very, very commonly.
So I'll go back on what I said before then. Is charcoal and fire potentially the best way of looking at plant fossils?
It is probably one of the best. If you were to sort of rank preservational states, then sort of like plant impressions would be the sort of least useful. And then you get plant compressions where you might have plant cuticle preserved, you might have the morphology of the plant preserved, or you have anatomically preserved material in terms of permineralization or petrifaction. There's a difference between those two. A permineralization, the organic material is still present. But charcoalification is up there in terms of the actual preservation of the anatomical information that you need often to identify what the plants are. Now, the other key feature is not just the fact that you get this wonderful anatomy preserved, but the fact that a lot of these small fragments of plants have been ignored by everybody. So that when you start dissolving your rock up and finding them, you're finding new things all the time. I have a block of rock from the early Carboniferous, and there was a piece the size of my fist, which I dissolved up, and there's probably about 30 or 40 new plants I've still not had time to actually study yet.
Wow.
And in other words, every time you dissolve a rock up throughout the geological column, you'll probably find something new. because it's not a preservation state that people have really thought much about and realised the potential. It's a psychological thing, I think, because if you, as you go around, say, a modern wildfire site, if you've been to a place where there's been a heathland burning or a forest fire burning, and you see this blackened stuff on the forest floor, you don't see that. You just crunch it in under your feet. And you look at the trees which have been destroyed, and you just think of this as a destructive thing. But you don't realise that actually a lot of those, that shows charcoal fragments under your feet could give you an incredible amount of information. Because if you find them in the fossil record, it's telling you not only there were fires, but because you've got the anatomy of the charcoal preserved, it's telling you what plants were being burned. And that might be of some significance, because not all vegetation necessarily burns particularly well. So you might be learning something about the nature of fire systems at a particular time in geological history.
So we heard in Paleocast episode 4 about the world's first forests in the Devonian of Gilboa in New York. So does the first evidence for fire in the fossil record coincide with the first evidence for these forests?
Well, strangely enough, until about 20 years ago, we had very little evidence of fire in the Devonian. When my research student Ian Glasspool went to work with Diane Edwards in Cardiff, he started looking at some late Silurian plants and found that some of those were actually preserved as charcoal. So we now have evidence that as soon as plants got onto land, some of them got burned. But of course, these were very tiny, and one of the key features of fire in terms of its extent and spread is the amount of fuel that's available. So if you've only got these little tiny plants living near watercourses, even though some of them might burn from time to time, you're not going to get extensive fires. So as you suggest, you might imagine that as you go through the Devonian with the evolution of trees, you might start to see forest fires, and this is what I expected to see. But strangely enough, that when you start looking towards the late Devonian, you find big bits of charcoal, and I always assume that those big bits of charcoal were from trees of the late Devonian. Still, we started looking at that material under the scanning electron microscope and found actually that some of them belonged to ferns. They weren't actually pieces of wood of progymnosperms or any of these large trees. So the question then became, why is it that you don't find so much charcoal through most of the Devonian, even when you get the first forests? By the time you get to the Devonian Carboniferous boundary, and certainly into the early Carboniferous, you find masses of charcoal everywhere. So at that stage, you're getting forests, you're getting other types of vegetation, not just where there are trees, but shrubland vegetation burning as well. So what is the we might ask ourselves, what's changed from the Devonian to the Carboniferous to allow it to have rather few fires, even when there were significant forests, to being many fires? Well, it comes down to the other aspect of your equation. We talked about having a fuel to burn, so you don't get fires before the first vegetation on land. But the second was a heat source, and of course you might say, well, where's that come from? Well, it's often lightning strike. Mm-hmm. And we know there are fossil lightning strikes. For example, in the Permian of Aran, there are what are called fulgurites. These are these fused sand tubes which are thought to be representing evidence of lightning strikes. So we know even in the Paleozoic there's plenty of lightning. So the third element must be oxygen, because we talked about why you get burning and we need oxygen. And the issue then becomes, if you've got if you ask somebody, how do you put your fire out? If you've got a fire in the house, how do you put it out?
Water.
We have water.
You can smother it.
You can smother it. So why, you might say, are you putting on water or you're smothering it? Smothering it, you're getting rid of the oxygen. You're starving that fire of oxygen so it goes out. Equally, water, you're doing the same, because of course that heat then has to evaporate the water. So those have the effect of putting a fire out. But equally, if you don't have enough oxygen in the air, you can't even start a fire or allow it to spread. So modelling had suggested there had been people looking at biogeochemical modelling to look at atmospheric oxygen through time, and it was suggested that through much of the Devonian, oxygen levels, although they would have been, you know, about 15-17%, actually hadn't risen enough to allow extensive fires to take place. So we now believe that actually that sort of fire gap, if you like, for much of the mid to late Devonian relates to the fact that that oxygen levels in the atmosphere were never much above 17%. And I think that's significant. So that by the time you get to the Carboniferous, when you get oxygen levels going above the present level of 21%, you had both the fuel and you had the oxygen in the atmosphere to allow these fires to really, you know, take hold and spread across the world.
So could you expand that and almost use charcoal as a proxy for the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere?
Yes, I think one of the things we came down to thinking about was that how could you do this? This is, you know, if fire truly, there have been, even from the days that Bill Challoner, my former PhD supervisor, had started to look at this issue of could the fossil record tell us about periods in the history when oxygen levels were below a certain threshold? In other words, if we had no record of charcoal, could that mean that oxygen levels were below 15-17%? I say 15 or 17% because different types of experiment have been done which suggest both figures. Most people now think that perhaps 17% is a good figure to think about, that if you don't have charcoal, then the oxygen level is probably below 17%. However, for most of Earth history, we have got charcoal. So we know that for most of the period of since the Silurian, for the most part, we've had above 17% oxygen. So then the question becomes, is that can we get any more information? Could it tell us about whether oxygen levels are above the present level of 21%? Because that's what we have currently is a 21% atmospheric oxygen. And so experiments have been done initially by Andrew Watson and then by a whole number of other people, Bob Berner and others, who had done a series of experiments to try to see what happens if you raise atmospheric oxygen, whether that impacts upon burning behaviour. And several bits of information are pertinent to this is that firstly, of course, one of the limits to burning today is how dry your vegetation is. I mean, why we don't get fires in southern England in the winter is, frankly, because it's too wet. In other words, you know, you might have the fuel there in terms of the vegetation, but frankly, you're not going to burn much because it's too wet. So that is a key condition. So you learn, for example, fire weather in, say, North America. People are looking at what the fuel moisture is like. To whether or not there's going to be a fire. So the first thing then of the controls would be the amount of fuel, secondly is that moisture content in the fuel, and thirdly is the oxygen content. Now, it so happens that as you increase oxygen content in the atmosphere, you can do two things. You can actually burn wetter and wetter plants. In other words, the limit at which the fire will spread changes. So that if you increase oxygen above 23%, 25%, 30%, you can burn wetter and wetter plants. And research done several years ago by Andrew Watson suggested that, in fact, if you got above 30, 35%, you might never be able to put a fire out because you could burn almost saturated plants. I don't suggest you do the experiment, but I used to, before health and safety came in, you could do an experiment where you had a tube filled with oxygen and you could put in sort of like a smouldering cigarette and put it in and it just flashes away. Just incredibly, I mean, it's too dangerous to do. That's why you can't get commission, because, you know, if you've got a room full of oxygen, you do not want to have flames nearby. That's obvious. So you get to a limit by which if you had a very high oxygen atmosphere, you would never be able to put the fire out. And by that time, then you get rid of all your vegetation, and then that would change the whole system anyway. So there's a limit. So we started to think, well, could you use these limits to try to understand what, you know, how you could define where fire is and what the charcoal record is? And we thought that perhaps the best way, Ian Glasspool and myself, thought that if you looked at modern peats, peats are important because they form in wetland environments. And wherever you find peat forming, it has to be in a wetland, an ever-wet environment. Or else peats don't form. If you look in modern peats around the world today, they contain about 4% charcoal. And that's kind of a useful, where, you know, this is a global mean average. It probably, there will be some places that might go up to 8% and some places they're less than 4%. But a global mean of all peat deposits around the world is about 4% charcoal. So we started looking at ancient coal deposits because they're essentially fossil peats. And we began to realize that the amount of charcoal in coal through time varied considerably. And that during periods, for example, in the Permian, you had coals which might be up to 70% charcoal. 70% charcoal. And so we did a simple mathematical calculation whereby if you have below 15%, you're not going to get any fire. And if you get above 30, 35%, you just wouldn't have them anymore because everything would have burnt. And we then got a situation whereby we did a transformation of all the data. This is looking global data, hundreds upon hundreds of records per every 10 million years. So it's a lot of data. And we realized that there were periods in Earth history in which oxygen levels were significantly higher than today. One of these periods was the late Carboniferous Permian, and the other, probably significant, was in the Cretaceous. So those were the two things, and probably you might have had in your paleocast people talking about the fact in the Carboniferous that they reckon there was high oxygen from the fact there were giant dragonflies.
Mm-hmm.
So it would seem that both the geochemical models where people have suggested high oxygen, some of the biological information suggested there was high oxygen, and our, if you like, charcoal from coal proxy in terms of atmospheric oxygen all seem to coincide. So that in itself became significant of thinking, well, if you've got high oxygen, has impact upon fire systems, and then we can talk about maybe the significance of if you've got lots of fire, what that might mean to a world.
So what does that mean to a world?
Well, if you think of it today, if you just look at today's world, one of the big features of fire is it occurs in certain vegetation types more than others. So, for example, you know that Western US there are always fires, and every Christmas you'll find fires being reported in Australia or fires being reported in Africa. The thing to say for Africa, for example, is that if you didn't have fire in Africa, you wouldn't have savannas, because you need fire on a regular basis to keep open grasslands present. So fire has an impact upon the type of vegetation present. It's been shown that if you take fire out of Africa, you wouldn't have savannas. You would only have shrubland and forest. So that in itself is significant. So there's a vegetational impact. But there's also a fact that you get what we call post-fire erosion. That is, where you've got an extensive fire, you're actually stripping the vegetation off the surface so that when there's a rainstorm, you get mass movement of sediment. And so you get enormous flooding and movement of sediment. Sometimes huge alluvial fans can form overnight in say, in Western US. And sometimes you get flooding maybe 30 or 40 kilometres downstream from where the fire was, because these floods are just the water comes streaming off the hillsides into the river systems, and you can get floods 40 miles away where you didn't even realise there had been a fire. You know, and of course, one of the big imperatives is how do you prevent that, because of course people are suing the forestry service for the floods in their houses. They want people to do something. So there's been a lot of research looking at this. Now, if you have today this whole issue of post-fire erosion and sedimentation, where you might get more than 30 times the amount of sediment coming off a system, you know, a huge increase in sedimentation, what's going to happen in the fossil record when there's fire? Not just in the normal periods where there's normal oxygen, but when there's elevated oxygen. If you look at most sedimentology textbooks that deal with, say, more ancient sediments, the word fire doesn't occur in the index. Post-fire erosion doesn't occur in the index. And so most geologists, for example, are not aware that that has a significant impact on the system. So we're only now beginning to sort of see this in the fossil record, because, you know, until you know it's there, you might not start looking. But once you start looking, you see it much more commonly. And there are a whole number of systems in the Carboniferous Permian, but particularly also in the Cretaceous, where, you know, evidence of major post-fire erosion and flooding. And we can talk about, well, you might think about, what else do we want to know about on land? If you've got vegetation, what else have you got? I mean, what does everybody else look at? I mean, you must have all your paleocasts.
Oh, they're all mainly about what? Dinosaurs.
Yeah, about animals.
Yeah.
So, and dinosaurs, and people love dinosaurs. Well, you think if the Cretaceous is a period where there are a lot of dinosaurs, and you've got a lot of fire, that's going to have a significant impact upon what they're eating, because it's being burnt away. But also, if you've got post-fire erosion, you may have flooding events that entomb dinosaurs.
So these post-fire erosion, so I'm just getting my head around this. The trees and the plants are preventing all of these flooding events by their uptake of water.
Yeah, they're actually allowing the water, the rainfall, to go into the surface that soaks down through that litter layer into the soil. And because of all the mats and roots and the vegetation, that just sort of, you know, comes down in. But you need a lot of rain for it to actually flow over the surface, because it just gets absorbed onto the surface. You know, probably people have experience in their gardens that when they've, for example, weeded their garden and you've got an open area and then you water it, you find the water just flows off the surface, you know, and doesn't it get absorbed? But if you've got all the plants there, they're holding the water in. They're actually not allowing the water to flow off the surface. So if you've got vast areas of hill slopes which now suddenly have no binding roots to the soil, have all that litter's been burnt away, then when the rains come, you can get mass movement of sediment, really significant amounts of sediment moving. I mean, you can fill up large oxbow lakes in one night with sediment, you know, on a modern fire. And on your site, we'll put some photographs on so people can see the effect that one night's rain has had after a fire. It is quite phenomenal.
And so with some of these, if you get a really big deposit of dinosaurs, can you find evidence of charcoal in these deposits?
Yeah, I mean, Sarah Brown, my PhD student, and I and Margaret Collinson, we just published on this, whereby we've shown that some of these dinosaur deposits in Canada, in the Dinosaur Provincial Park, actually do have charcoal associated with them. And we believe that that's a potential scenario, that they actually do relate to post-fire erosion depositional systems. And at least people need to think about, for the first time, you know, the impact that fires might have had at these different periods of Earth history.
So you've mentioned that fire occurs more often than not in certain types of vegetation. Is that the case in the fossil record as well?
Yeah, I think if we take that Cretaceous example we were looking at, the thing about the Cretaceous, which we think was a high fire world, is that the vegetation through the Cretaceous changed quite dramatically. We know, for example, that in the early Cretaceous, that vegetation that dominated the world was essentially coniferous forests with undergrowth of ferns, and there were cycads and other plants. But it was in the early Cretaceous that our first flowering plants evolved. And these flowering plants were quite interesting because most of them were tiny weeds. And therefore they could grow very quickly in disturbed environments, it's believed. Now, if you think of it, our knowledge of early flowering plants comes from two, I suppose, major sources. One is on the fossil record itself, and the second is from molecular studies which are being done at the moment. And the two now are beginning to tell us a very interesting story. In terms of the fossil record, our early record of flowers has been extended hugely in the last 20, 30 years by work of Elsa Marie Fries and Pete Crane and others, where they found the flowers preserved as charcoal. And these are small charcoalified flowers, absolutely gorgeous. But the linkage then with fire becomes very interesting. It could be that actually, if we've got very frequent fires, These will help promote the spread of these early flowering plant weeds because it keeps the trees down, mm-hmm. keeps the spaces open in which these flowering plants can spread. So that's the first thing. And secondly, of course, that because the charcoal preserves the anatomy, we said about the flowers being preserved, but all the different kinds of plant material preserved in their anatomy. So in the early Cretaceous, if you look, for example, in the Wealden of the Isle of Wight or elsewhere in southern England, or in some other early Cretaceous sites in Europe and North America or even in the southern hemisphere, you find they're full of beautifully preserved charcoalified plants, conifers, but also ferns. You would think of ferns being fairly flimsy things that wouldn't survive, but they are beautifully preserved ferns as charcoal in many of these deposits. And so we see that, and as we go through the Cretaceous, the nature of the vegetation being preserved as charcoal changes, so that we begin to see not only then evidence of coniferous forest burning, but later on in the Cretaceous we see evidence of angiosperm trees, so flowering plant trees coming in and being burnt in fire systems. So fire, you know, trying to understand the nature of fire helps us understand, gives us, if you like, information about the types of plants which are being preserved, and the anatomy being preserved in the plants tells us about how those plants might have lived. And then if you start looking at the molecular work that's been done over the last 3 or 4 years, there's been people who've been trying to map out phylogenetically traits relating to fire. So, for example, features where, for example, we know that certain types of bark have evolved to actually prevent the trees dying from fire. You know, you can get surface fires going through forests where the bark is actually preserving the plants and they don't get killed. And then you get other plants which have developed traits which allow them to take advantage of the fact that they can reproduce quickly after fire. And those fire traits, if you map them on molecular trees, seem to now have their origins in the Cretaceous. There have been several groups of plants, including the pine group, and there's a whole number of proteaceous plants, some of the southern hemisphere plants, including Banksia itself, have their origin of fire adaptation mapped molecularly, not on the fossil, necessarily just on the fossil record, but molecularly mapped into the Cretaceous. So the fact that Cretaceous was a high fire world is really quite significant, and one which I think geologists and paleontologists as a whole need to think more carefully about, because the impact of fire in those systems may have been quite significant.
Probably the most major event in the Cretaceous was the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs, and it's been suggested that there was also a worldwide fire that happened at this event. Is there any evidence for that?
I think it's interesting, because that's one thing. I'd spent my career trying to persuade people of fire in the fossil record. So when this idea of a fire relating to the KT impact came in on board, I was really excited. I thought, this is great. This is putting fire on the map. Except when you start looking, the evidence is not there. And indeed, we first started looking at this, and I realised that the problem was that the people who had suggested it hadn't spent their lives looking at charcoal through the fossil record and realising it's everywhere. In fact, all through the Cretaceous it's everywhere. So that they find something at the KT boundary doesn't mean, say, there was a global fire. So one of our research students, Claire Belcher, who was working with Margaret Collinson and myself here at Royal Holloway, we got her looking at all the KT sites around the world, particularly in North America. And we came to the conclusion there was no global fire at the KT boundary. Even though you might see it on the Horizon programs or on the, you know, TV or on in people's papers, to be honest with you, there isn't any significant evidence that there was a global wildfire at this time. There certainly in the Cretaceous were lots of fires, as there were in the very earliest Tertiary, in the very earliest Cenozoic. But generally speaking, there's no evidence of a sort of a global wildfire. And when you think about it, and you know about how fires work, it's actually very unlikely to have happened in that way. Because there's lots of different types of vegetation in different conditions of moisture. To actually have a global fire and spread it in that way is actually very, it's going to be very difficult anyway. But there was no evidence of increased fire at the KT boundary.
So I've been working on a few scripts for future episodes. Hopefully we've got a mammal evolution episode lined up. And I'm going to be talking to some of the people I go to the synchrotron with about what exactly is the synchrotron and how we can use it to look at tiny fossils in super high detail.
Huh. I haven't got any scripts. I'm just going to conferences.
What conferences are you attending?
You know, I've already told everyone. I don't think you want to hear any more about this. Hey, if you're going to a conference, be sure to say hi to me. I'll be there in a Paleocast t-shirt on my own with a recorder.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.